It's The Wonky Show.
OFS is redesigning regulation again. We'll discuss the holes it's trying to plug. The Lords have been intervening on visas and commuter students are in focus. It's all coming up.
There is a challenge in HE around governance and ensuring that some of the things that have either slipped off the table or where short-term decisions that are not in the best interest of the sector or the institutions are being taken.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to sign some HE policy executive orders. As usual, three top-level guests. In Newington Green, Omar Khan is chief executive of Tazo. Omar, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was actually over the weekend. I watched this animated film called Flow. I don't know if you've heard about it, but I didn't realize this was going to happen, but I got a Q&A from the Latvian director afterwards to explain why there was no dialogue in this animated film.
Oh, that sounds right up my street. Good. Link for that in the show notes. In Oxted, Charlotte Corrish is head of public policy at the Office of the Independent Adjudicator. Charlotte, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, Jim, is actually from last week, and it's seeing my 14-year-old daughter perform in her school show. And just seeing her passion and enthusiasm on the stage made me reflect on how important our creative and performance opportunities are for young people.
Oh, fantastic. And in Salisbury this week, David Kernahan is deputy editor at Wonky. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, let's go for the Bristol Flyers putting 122 points past the Cheshire Phoenix on Sunday night. An incredible little score and a nice return to form for the team after the trophy final disappointment.
Translation in the show notes. So yes, we start this week with OFS. It's consulting on two new conditions of registration on student protection and governance. DK, what are the questions to which all of this is the answer?
Right, so these are initial conditions of registration. That's the important bit. It's stuff that when the regulator finally gets round to actually processing registration requests in August, we think. There will be some new rules that providers have to follow in order to get their application in correctly and get accepted onto the register. There are two of them in the main. Condition C5 deals with consumer rights and tidies up a lot of mess and uncertainty about the way consumer law applies to applicants and to students, particularly when providers start changing aspects of their offer, and it sets out clearly the right that students have in those circumstances. There's also condition E7, which is about just getting more accurate information about the way a provider is governed and managed. It includes the wonderful aspect that there will be interviewing senior members of applying providers to make sure that they're decent persons and they know the stuff that they claim they're meant to know about. There's also a couple of twiddles about financial information, that the financial forecasts that providers offer are now also going to be assessed against a couple of scenarios. OFS have spotted, I can't sing how they spotted this, can you? That providers tend to be over-optimistic about their income and the years after registration, and that tends not to be borne out in reality, so they've got some extra scenarios in the pot for them to deal with. It's all decent stuff. The only problem for me is, why does it only apply to new providers and why can't we extend some of this stuff to existing providers?
Well, fascinating stuff. Now, obviously there's been some controversy about the pausing of new registrations, of new providers onto the register. I mean, is this just, they must have been wading through all sorts of stuff and they've come up with some stuff to make sure that they can kind of wade through things quicker?
Well, presumably the Office for Students has spotted some issues with governance for these providers, and that's the reason why they're trying to tighten up to ensure the governance arrangements for these new providers are, up to standard. As David says, the question, of course, is also, what about governance arrangements for older providers or for existing providers, rather? And, I think there are different ways in which higher education providers are governed. I think we talk about governance generally, and if you look at the sort of way in which different institutions constitute sector governance structures, it is a bit peculiar. There is a sort of lack of consistency, I think, across the sector. At the same time, I think those arrangements have developed over time and in most cases do work. I don't think we should be sort of inherently skeptical of governance arrangements, but I do think it's important to query just because we've done things in a way that's tended to work in the past. Are they fit for purpose for a very different experience of higher education, for sort of mass higher education, for a time when obviously there's other concerns for the welfare of students that original governance arrangements for some of our older universities weren't designed to tackle. So I think, yeah, scrutiny on governance is a good thing. I think there's must be some evidence, of course, that some of those arrangements haven't been fit for purpose in the past. And I think ensuring not just that new providers that are on the register, but that all providers have good governance arrangements is key, not just as a sort of legal or regulatory concern, but obviously for the welfare of students themselves.
And governance seems to be the you know, the word of the week. Here's a clip of Jackie Smith earlier this week.
That there are several issues that we are dealing with now. The whole decision-making about the financial and business model. Arguably, some of the controversy around freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I was talking to families whose children had died by suicide in higher education. In each of these cases, it feels to me as if there has been some element of governance failure. And to be honest, that's what vice chancellors would also say to me. So I think, you know, how we go about doing it, you know, I think is as of this moment, we haven't quite decided. But I think it is fair to say that there is a challenge in HE around governance and ensuring that some of the things that have either slipped off the table in terms of real high-level governance consideration, or where short-term decisions that are not in the best interest of the sector or the institutions are being taken. I think that is a fair.
DK, there's a particular, I mean, look, you know, you say the word governance, you might be talking about academic governance, you might be talking about, you know, chit-chats about educational character and mission, but there's a particular focus here, isn't there?
A lot of the stuff in the new condition, E7 on governance, is looking at corporate governance, the kind of stuff that you'd expect to read in stuff that comes from Companies House, that kind of thing. Fit and proper people, have you got your risk register being reviewed the appropriate number of times, how often does your board meet, that kind of thing. Now, that's all important stuff. I'm not going to do that down for a second. But as a regulator of higher education, and as education more generally, you'd think it would take a view on the world of academic governance. Now, this has been controversial over the time, in that academics tend to govern institutions in ways that make sense for academics to do so. It's not often as codified as maybe we might like. We get the whole concept of academic judgment when you come to assessment and criteria for acceptance. And that is an important part of the sector that is quite hard to regulate. It is it's notable in this publication that OFS, they've not really gone there. They're talking about structures. They're talking about overarching stuff. They say explicitly they don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of the way things are actually done. But if you want to have a provider that's performing in the interest of students, which is the overall understanding of all of this, then I would say that you have to do that. You have to get in there.
Yes, well, I'm fascinated. And, you know, all sorts of tensions between kind of, you know, autonomy and presumably some of the things that it's come across as it's been registering new providers. Now, Charlotte, the other big thing is this new condition of registration on treating students fairly, which is, you know, a bit of tanks on your lawn.
So from our point of view, any protections and anything that for students, that anything makes it clearer to students what they can expect and what they can do about it if they feel that those expectations have been met, and anything that places complaints and refunds policies up the agenda in providers is to be welcomed. I think what's really interesting, as we've already talked about, is how this aligns with providers that are already on the register. And I think if I was working in one of those providers, I would be starting to review my documentation and thinking that perhaps at some point the regulator will align the current conditions with these initial conditions. I can't see that they're going to want different conditions applying to different providers at different times. I think the focus on the financial sustainability element is really positive, but I do think there needs to be some more fundamental change in this space, and that's not within the gift of the OFS, but ultimately if a provider goes into an insolvency process, students are still going to be unsecured creditors, whatever the refunds policy says, whatever the complaints policy says. So it'd be great to see something similar to that within FE, where students are at the top of the list of creditors, and that perhaps we can rely on these policies to enable students to get their refunds or indeed access a pot of money that is provided when a provider goes into insolvency.
DK, this thing about different regulatory standards for different providers, I think you can just about see how that is justifiable with a whole bunch of presumably waiting in the queue new small often for profit providers, although the distinction being drawn isn't for profit or small particularly, it's new versus currently on. But how on earth can OFS justify a bunch of intro material saying we've talked to current students and they're upset about being treated unfairly, and then introduce a condition of registration that won't cover them?
It does feel like there is another shoe about to drop, that we are going to at some point see a consultation replacing some of the ongoing conditions of registrations that apply to current providers. This is obviously the way in which OFS is thinking is moving. It is nice to see them, and I know we're not often as kind to OFS as we could be on this podcast. It is nice to see them engaging with the feedback they've had about the way the sector is currently working and moving in to addressing some of those problems. And I think it is inevitable that it is going to have to extend eventually into the world of the more established universities. I mean, OFS knows this stuff. If something goes horribly wrong, God forbid, students aren't protected in the way that they would be under these conditions, there would be a lot of awkward questions to be asked about OFS's regulatory competence. You already know this stuff, but yet you're regulating under the old rules. So the idea of treating providers differently, that does come in the governance conditions. And a nice part of that I did like is that they are looking at the provider's own goals, own aim. And I mean, rather than assessing those goals in the sense of saying, no, we don't need another business college doing HNDs in London, we've got plenty of them. They're saying, okay, given that this is the thing that you want to do, your aspiration, are you actually doing the things that are going to get you there? Is your plan credible based on your own aims? And I think that is rather nice. And I think sometimes in the way we've been regulating traditional universities, we've assumed they've all had similar aims where they might not. And this principle, if applied properly across the rest of the sector, it could lead to more diversity of mission and more providers actually finding places where they can act and make a difference to their local community, to particular groups or particular industries that they care about.
Now, before we discuss any more of this, DK, just quickly explain, because we sort of missed this. This is classic, podcast rhythm doesn't quite match. Right at the end of last week, we also got a bunch of stuff from OFS about regulating franchise providers, didn't we?
So this was mad in that it didn't come from OFS. It came from the Department for Education, who has decided that if you're delivering higher education to more than 300 students, whether or not they're doing your own awards or somebody else's, you need to be registered with the OFS. It would have made sense for this to come alongside the announcement of, okay, these are the new criteria that you need to meet in order to register, and you can do it from August. It didn't, which I thought was rather weird. If you've been reading the stuff coming from the Public Accounts Committee and the National Audit Office, you'll know that the Department for Education, Student Loans Company, and the Office for Students have been quite strongly criticized for the way they have dealt with the phenomenon of providers delivering higher education under franchise that are behaving, and let's not mince words here, in a fraudulent manner, that they are keeping money that comes from the government to pay for teaching while not spending the majority of that on teaching, and that they're allowing students to apply for maintenance grants without any real expectation that the students are actually going to do the course that they're going to do. Now, this has been a huge problem. It's raised eyebrows in the Treasury, and it's all over government. So this move, which came from, we say it again, from DfE, not from OFS, is a suggestion that some pretty serious pressure is being put on DfE's financial management, and something needed to be done.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, Omar? Because if you look at the kind of socioeconomic and student characteristics makeup of franchising, and there's quite a bit in the arguments about this, actually. There's a hell of a lot of WP going on.
Yeah, so as with the previous discussion around new providers, obviously some of this is about not just diversity of provision, but actually expanding provision to those students who previously didn't access higher education. And so on the one hand, we should, I think, be welcome the fact that there's not just diversity of provision for the sake of diversity itself, but because widening participation students might have particular needs that the sector is presently not making. I think at the same time, it would be a big error, obviously, if WP students or widening participation students had less protection or more likely to be studying on courses that were perceived to have less protection or less value. And so I do think it's sensible that there's a focus on effective regulation there. But I think there is a tension, I think, between trying to sort of limit provision to existing providers and trying to expand access. And I think, you know, one thing or one point of intelligence that other providers might want to take is if WP students are more interested in this kind of provision, perhaps they should also be thinking about whether or not they want to compete for these students as well.
But I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? And you know, without oversimplifying it, you know, you run an organization that is dedicated to working out what works in this space. And I guess one of the questions is, when you're saying, well, that works, do we mean striking a partnership with a for-profit that's rented a kind of office block around the edge of London? Or do we mean widening participation in the actual location where the university is based and, you know, with all of the challenges that brings? You know, do both count as working?
Well, yes, I think access needs to be both and rather than either or. We need to see improved representation amongst free school meal kids, for example, at the high tariff universities. But we also have to recognize that, especially given existing inequalities in the education system, that some of those high tariff institutions are not going to be accessible. And unless we're satisfied that we're going to wait 20 years or however long it's going to take to close those gaps in schools, then we have to accept that there's going to be a lot of WP activity and good WP activity at lower tariff and indeed new providers. I think at the same time, the second bit of my organization, but of course, I think policymakers and indeed universities' interests, is the outcomes bit. I think we can't just be focused on shoving as many students in the door and not being concerned about what happens to them when they get in the institution or on the course or indeed after in the labor market. I do think there is a further complication here, and it was picked up in your piece. I mean, when we are sort of providing information, when universities are providing information to students about, say, the average return on earnings from a particular course or from their university, that of course hides the fact that for disadvantaged students, those returns will be lower. And it's always been, of course, a question mark. To what extent are the lower returns for free school meal kids related to the quality or nature of the provision in higher education that they're more likely to attend? And to what extent does it reflect wider, you know, social or economic factors that mean that working class students earn less regardless of what kind of university they attend? And we know the evidence there, which is that free school meal kids do get an increased return from education, whatever qualification, but that they get less return than their non-free school meal peers, regardless of the institution they go to. So I suppose both in the sense that we need to expand provision to meet the preferences of WP students and to ask existing providers to do better to meet the needs of those students. But also we need to be focusing not just on access, but on those outcomes.
One of the things I was going to ask you, Charlotte, was, and I have absolutely no evidence for this, but I have this kind of theory that in order to kind of do that thing where you would make a complaint and potentially, if you're not then happy with the kind of result of that complaint internally, get as far as you need a certain level of kind of confidence, perhaps cultural capital and so on. Do we have any kind of intel or sense of the kind of differential levels of confidence to complain between, say, I don't know, a student in a for-profit provider that's been franchised to in London versus, you know, an upset student in, you know, on campus somewhere in a big city in a Russell Group university? Do we have any sense of the confidence differential?
I don't think we have any evidence of that, but I think anecdotally, I mean, at the OIA, we've had franchise providers in membership for quite some time now, and that has allowed us to kind of reach some of those students. And I think it's fair to say, because of the structures and the lack of student unions often in those providers, there is less support for those students to make complaints. And so that's something that I think we're quite cognizant of. Some providers allow students to access their student union at the lead provider, but others, it's more remote. So one of the things that we're quite interested in is we always look at this from a student protection point of view rather than a public money point of view. So it is a slightly different angle, but I'm very interested in the kind of 300 student threshold and whether that might move over time. Obviously, it's got to be proportionate, and with things like LLE and things coming down the track, the OFS needs to, or the DfE needs to be mindful of how burdensome this process becomes. But I do think where we're talking about student protection, having a threshold like that does seem a little bit odd, and it'll be interesting to see if that then moves over time.
But Omar, I mean, presumably, you know, one of the markers, you know, one of the kind of data sets is first in family, and certainly in this kind of franchised space, certainly in these kind of bigger franchised places where lots of them have been running lots of foundation years and so on, huge percentages of students that are first in family. And, you know, presumably, I mean, one of my assumptions is, you know, if you're not really happy with what's happening, and you talk to your uncle so-and-so and your mum and dad about, you know, the quality of your lectures and so on, you might clock that what it is that you're experiencing that you've never experienced before isn't quite up to scratch. But presumably for first in family students, this is their only, you know, they have no other reference points to work out whether or not what they're experiencing is good or bad. And by the time we work out their labour market outcomes, it might be too late, mightn't it?
Yes, I agree. I mean, just because widening participation students have a preference for a certain kind of provision, we shouldn't just assume that that's naturally, you know, the best way to fulfill their aspirations and what they and their expectations. And particularly if we see things like very high complaints or inability to access complaints, or like higher dropout rates or low, returns in the labor market, I do think those are concerns. We shouldn't just be relaxed about those kinds of outcomes for those students. And it's not good enough simply to recruit students who then don't have a good experience. But at the same time, I think, you know, we do have to meet people where they are. We have to understand there are reasons why, as you say, certain kinds of students see certain kind of provision that's maybe closer to them, that's local, that might be smaller as well, that might be more familiar to, for example, a college experience as something that they would seek out. Obviously, this also raises questions about different pathways and how you move across different kinds of qualifications or courses. Perhaps in year one, you might realize, actually, I really did need that first year on this course to get settled, to understand, to navigate attending lectures or going to higher education, but then might think, actually, I would prefer some other kind of provision. And obviously, that's a weak area in our policy context and institutional context now. So I think that's another issue, is that once you've made that choice in year one, you're kind of often locked into a three-year offer. And, you know, I've been saying that people have preferences about what they want, but until they experience, and I think this goes for actually, you know, more traditional residential university life as well, until you actually experience it, you might not realize that the sort of preference that you had in your mind isn't really matched by the reality on the ground. And so, you know, I do think there's definitely a role for ensuring that not just complaints, but that, you know, satisfaction and experience on course is adequately considered for all students, regardless of provision. So, yeah, I wouldn't want to miss out on the fact that this provision does, and I think it's a key aspect of it, that it does target and is attractive to widening participation students. But I wouldn't want it to be limited to them. And I think there's always this risk that we design a different offer for widening participation students. We have different expectations for them. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily lead to the best outcomes or even the best experience for them.
And DK, just on this, I mean, you know, if I really zoom out and I'm trying to kind of explain some of this to, you know, people who are really immersed in higher education and so on, I think the moment I always get stuck is where I'm trying to say, look, you know, the people that are most likely to be in large profit-making providers are the people with the least experience of HE and potentially the highest support needs. Something doesn't add up about that, does it?
It really doesn't add up. I guess that your issue there is we're thinking about higher education as a single entity. There's lots of different higher educations, and somebody straight from school signing up to do a three-year undergraduate degree at a big famous university is not the same thing as somebody who's working already and starts doing a HND part-time or any other level four, level five qualification, anything like that. Students that are less traditionally involved in higher education tend to be involved in less traditional higher education when they do. It is a sign of the way that the sector is evolving, that we're offering all this other stuff. But because the sector Canada historically has always done this three-year go away to university model. There's a lot of capabilities, a lot of understanding that the sector, in the most part, just hasn't got. I still don't think, even though, I mean, we've been dealing with part-time students living locally, doing non-traditional qualifications for a long time, I don't think we've yet got the understanding of what good looks like in those contexts outside of a few things. And in a way, I think this is what the new condition of registration is trying to address, that there are lots of ways in which this could look good. We don't know what good looks like, but we need to base it on what the provider is actually trying to do and the kind of students it is trying to get.
Yeah. And then just one other thing on this, Charlotte. So whether you're a sort of provider or actually whether you're a student and, you know, you're trying to work out what fair looks like with lots of other pressures, there's case summaries from you, there's a kind of emerging, you know, a consultation has just closed on CMA's interpretation of new version of consumer protection law, and then there's this new definition that RFS is kind of souping up and adding to on fairness that takes consumer protection law and then adds to it. It's very complicated to work out what counts as fair here, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think we obviously, fairness is one of our good practice framework principles. We have 10 of them in total, so we have some context to that on our website and within the good practice framework itself. And we obviously take into account in when we're reviewing complaints any guidance that providers should be following, whether that's from OFS or UK or other documents. And really what we're looking at, we don't see so much nowadays that processes themselves are drafted unfairly. Often where we see this coming to bite is in the application of those processes in the individual student complaints. So often on paper, processes are fair and reasonable, but actually what we see is in the day-to-day application of that, something just goes a bit wrong. And often kind of things like bias come in and other principles from our good practice framework. So that's really where we see this coming out for students.
And DK, this is the thing, isn't it? Because as you say, these are proposed as the initial conditions of registration, which is about whether people are allowed on the register. But we'd have to assume that A, they're going to become ongoing conditions, and B, they're going to end up applying to everyone, aren't they? Surely.
Well, if it doesn't happen, OFS is arguably in breach of its duties as a regulator. It has the information that the existing way it's been regulating this stuff has not worked. It has evidence of the problems, I mean, both in terms of the student experience and in terms of actual fraudulent use of public funds. And it has already designed a way of assessing these that makes sense in terms of the kind of institutions it deals with and expects to deal with. The idea that it's going to think, okay, but this doesn't apply to people that are already on the register, which are absolutely fine. And that's not the case. I mean, one of the places that we're in, that the National Audit Office report talked about way back when was actually on the OFS register. So it's like, okay, you've clearly got a problem with the way you're dealing with this stuff.
Fascinating. Well, plenty more on the site about all of this as ever. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Elizabeth Gadd, and this week I've been pondering as to whether there might be another way of approaching the critically important National Assessment of People, Culture and Environment, PCE, in the next REF. Given we're already halfway through the REF period, and as a sector are facing significant financial challenges, I suggest that it might be worth seeing this as a stepping stone REF when it comes to PCE, one in which we make better use of existing REF mechanisms, such as the use of codes of practice to ensure all universities hit a basic standard for PCE, the use of PCE data that's provided but not assessed, just as research income and PGR data was provided but not directly assessed in 2021, and that the assessment element of PCE should simply be a context-sensitive evaluation of an institution's efforts to understand and then plan and monitor improvements to their research cultures, with a view to institutions then being expected to show improvement against their own research culture ambitions in REF 2036.
now. Current UK visa policy for scientists and researchers is an act of national self-harm. Who's saying this, Omar?
So this was said by the House of Lords Science and Technology Committee this week. So not people who ordinarily, I suppose, are inclined towards hyperbole. It was a letter to the Chancellor, Home Secretary, and Science Minister Patrick Balance, who you may recall from the coronavirus pandemic, and is now a science minister. The letter follows to him follows a hearing back in January, which took evidence from Universities UK and the Royal Society. And the committee concurs with witnesses' arguments that government policies on immigration are harming UK science and research. It covers things like the immigration health surcharge, the PGT postgraduate dependence ban, and the politicizing of student numbers, as well as high visa fees compared to other countries. The committee ended up calling on the government to review the requirement for the immigration health surcharge to be paid up front in full, and to clarify and potentially expand the use of global talent visas. It also recommended that the government review the ban on dependents for postgraduate taught students and ask the Office for National Statistics to differentiate between permanent and temporary migrants in its reporting. And that does sound like it's increasingly likely. Obviously, the other context here is a sort of potential tension between the government's policies on growth and the government's commitments to trying to reduce migration.
Wow, interesting intervention. Now, DK, there's a immigration white paper, or is that right? An immigration white paper is coming, isn't it, I think?
We believe so, yeah. And it has been expected that there would be some kind of review of immigration and new proposals from the time that this government took power. There's been lots of expectation. There's been lots of pressure from the usual lobby groups that what we were left with at the end of the last government's term was unhelpful, unworkable, and damaging to the economy. Now, there has been a little bit of a lobbying operation also from a number of backbenchers in the north of England who are scared of losing their seats to the Reform Party, which is seemingly quite popular at the moment if you look at certain polls. Their pressure is simply on the idea of the kind of David Cameron style overall headline target of tens of thousands, which, as we've seen over the previous 15 years, is not really something the government has in its gift to control. The more rational end of government, I think, is looking at, okay, well, what are the people that we need to bring into the country in order to drive growth? A lot of those are going to have the kind of higher level skills that we don't currently have in the UK, but are working to gain in the UK. And I think in both of those aspects, this stuff particularly affects university. The big movement to me needs to come on improvements to the skilled worker visa. I like the idea of the talent visa, but the impact is tiny. It's really selective in the way it applies to people who've only won certain prizes. I think there was less than 50 people who got in through that route last year. But because the skilled worker visa and also the student visas are quite onerous in order to get, I was talking to somebody over the weekend, I think, about the immigration health surcharge, which is a ridiculously large amount of money. £1,000 or more is up front, and it's on top of the requirement to be able to support yourself during your stay. Really
often. To not get an appointment with your GP.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's not like we're offering anything spectacular for that £1,000. It's £1,000 a year. So, you know, if you're doing a taught master's and then you decide to expand on what you've learned and do a PhD, which is going to benefit the UK economy, I mean, both in terms of your personal spending and in terms of the knowledge you're unlocking, you have to keep paying and paying. So the £1,000 figure there, that applies to the skilled worker visa I was talking about. It is a bit cheaper for students. They do get a discount, but it is still a lot of money. We've got the dependent stuff in there, which kind of made sense on one level, in that if we're bringing dependents of students over, we need to make sure they can support themselves, and then we need to make sure that we can house them adequately. Ideally, they'd be able to work full-time as well, but that seems not to be an option at the moment. So there is a lot of good that can be done here in this review. It's just a question, as often in this government, how brave and how true to its principles that the Labour Party wants to be.
Charlotte, one of the things about this agenda, I think, is, you know, for for certainly the international students and the representatives I talk to, a hell of a lot of the kind of struggles they have and the problems they have is the kind of interaction between, on the one hand, this kind of huge, complicated, expensive immigration system, and then all the other things they've got to kind of contend with as students. And I can, you know, they're never clear. I'm never clear on the extent to which we ought to expect universities to help them navigate all of this complexity and cost and take it into account and enable them to succeed, or whether, you know, this is just something they've got to poke up with if they want their qualification.
Yeah, Jim, I think it's really important to remember that there are real students and people's futures behind all these statistics and policy decisions. I mean, we know from our data that international students are overrepresented, but also they have a lot of additional admin and costs, and that has a knock-on effect with stress and anxiety, and it can be incredibly isolating and lonely for them. Anecdotally, we also hear that they don't really want to raise complaints and appeals, and sometimes that can be cultural, but sometimes it's really about concern about cancellation of sponsorship or visas. And that's not necessarily because there's any evidence that providers are going to do that, but because the perception of the whole system is quite hostile and not welcoming. And of course, all of this is difficult from a growth and financial sustainability position. We've basically got a system that's built on the subsidy from international students, but we're continually sending out some very mixed messages about how those students are valued in our system.
And this thing about taking international students out of the net migration targets, I mean, that's been around forever, hasn't it? And you know, maybe it will happen, maybe it won't. But, you know, I mean, it seems to me, if you just look at the numbers that are presently here, on one level or another, some people are going to need to know how many, you know, international students there are at a given point, aren't they? Whether or not, you know, you end up knocking them off for the net reason.
Yeah, I think there's various reasons why students might be excluded from the numbers. I mean, I think it's also worth flagging at the outset that there have been some issues with the statistics on migration that have been flagged by the Office for National Statistics more recently as well, just generally. I mean, obviously, when under the Cameron government, there was this effort to try to reduce migration to the tens of thousands, that would have been almost impossible without excluding student numbers. I think there's also good reasons to exclude students kind of on a policy level, and that some of the concern around migration is that people are staying, and questions around integration and pressure on public services like schools when they have children, and when it comes to healthcare, which is obviously why the health surcharge was initially envisaged. But as you say, even if it's important to recognize that students are not always long-term residents, in the short term, they do need housing, and that housing, I mean, I know we're coming on to commuter students, does tend to be local. And so if we don't have a proper, assessment of the actual numbers on the ground in a particular location, we may not be, building the right kind of housing in the right kind of places. It may also mean that there needs to be additional transport. I think excluding the numbers from the net migration figure is a separate question from ensuring that local authorities and universities have adequate, accurate numbers for how many students are living in a particular area. One is a kind of question, do we know the actual numbers, and are we accounting for those kinds of local provision of housing? And the other is kind of a policy question, which, as David has also indicated, is a political question as well. And so I think there is an attempt, obviously, both to clarify that the policy issues with the public are not always related to international students. If you look at the polling, there's less concern amongst the public about international students when it comes to the kinds of immigrants that those voters that might be persuaded by reform that Labour MPs are concerned about. So that's the other reason why there's a sort of thought that we should exclude them from the figures, in addition to them not really being immigrants in the sense in which most people think of immigrants as longer-term residents.
DK, obviously, with an immigration white paper on the way, there's this usual thing that kind of floats around, certainly in my head, which is, oh, blimey, that'll be the Home Office in the front seat. But you've got DfE hanging around with its needs and concerns. And then, you know, you've got the Treasury concerned about economic performance and so on. And, you know, I mean, certainly if we look at other countries, there'd have to be at least a prospect that what we might end up with is a kind of relatively hard numbered cap rather than just fiddling with the rules and trying to predict what rule changes will do to numbers. But one of the things that I keep coming back to is on other podcasts, on other weeks, in other blogs and so on, there's a hell of a lot of devolution stuff going on. And, you know, metro mayors and, you know, bigger local authorities are about to be kind of trying to integrate stuff like social cohesion and responsibility eligibility for housing provision and economic performance and so on. So if you were going to have an international student number cap, wouldn't you give it to the Metro Met?
I mean, that's an actual episode of Yes, Minister Jim, as you well know. Can we have the London Borough of Islington having its own foreign policy? I would argue that probably we can't. The idea of an immigration cap, it addresses the perception of immigration. It doesn't, like, people, as I understand it, they're not as bothered by actual immigration. They don't mind that their mate that they work with and drink with comes from Poland. They don't mind the family down the street originally came from India. That's not an issue. It's the perception of, like, there's loads and loads of people coming from overseas, and it's, as I understand it, changing what it means to be English. You can tell I've been reading a lot of Matt Goodwin this week, haven't you? I'm really sorry. But the cap addresses the perception of immigration, but it has an impact on the actuality of immigration. And this is the reason that these policy decisions are so hard to make. If you do the sensible thing and you don't set a cap and you say, look, we will support people to come to the UK, I mean, like Scotland wants to do, and Scotland hasn't got its own devolved immigration plan as much as it would like to. That's good for the economy. It's good for our structures. It's good for the kind of creation of the growth that we need. But it will play really badly with the kind of usual commentators that will effectively say number go up brr, and be upset about that. On the other hand, if you set the hard cap, that has all of the impacts on the other stuff. I also wanted to address the idea of students being taken out of the immigration statistics. This is one of these all policy is data definition questions, which I love. Unfortunately, that is a requirement of the United Nations, I believe, that you need to include international students in immigration and emigration numbers. And there's not really a way around that unless we're going to stop providing whatever the global example of official statistics in. It would be convenient, I grant you. Wouldn't it be lovely if all of these student numbers didn't look as worrying as they are to some people? We don't get to do things that easy, and we need to make the positive case, as Universities UK is starting to do, as some universities are starting to do, that international students are good for the country, and having international students, I mean, why would you not want them?
Great stuff. Now, we've got an event coming up. Here's some fella to talk about it. Hello, it's Jim from the team here with news of our exciting student experience event in March. UKHE has a great reputation, but as the resource envelope tightens, it's not clear that what's been sold to students as a higher education experience can compensate for high costs, overcrowded facilities, and stressed out academic and support staff. The result? Widespread health and wellbeing issues, stubborn awarding gaps, and the erosion of opportunity as demand for higher education begins to slip. Some say the future lies in a great unbundling, but in truth, reports of the death of the full-time three-year degree have probably been greatly exaggerated. So with a new government, a renewed commitment to access and student success, and a regional regeneration agenda, there's an opportunity to build a different vision for a full-time student experience that acknowledges that students are citizens too. They're passengers, clients, patients, employees, voters, parents, volunteers, and taxpayers, each with their own distinct needs and future potential. So as our unique student experience event returns for its seventh year, we'll try to climb out of the doldrums over the student experience debate, asking the question, what would it take for the UK to offer the world's best student experience? We'll get beyond trying to discern the student interest and work towards an ambitious, positive vision for students' participation in higher education. We'll also spend some time interrogating some of the wicked problems associated with particular groups of students in HE. Disabled students, PGR students, students who live locally or less locally to their campus, and the students whose work-based learning means that even the word student, let alone the policy surrounding them, can seem alien. On the day, we'll round up key findings into the student experience from the past year and launch exciting new findings on the student experience beyond the classroom. It's the essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's the secret life of students at the Shaw Theatre in London on the 18th of March. We can't wait to see you there. Tickets and more details on wonky.com. Now, finally this week, we've launched a new article series on commuter students. What's going on here, Charlotte?
Yeah, so this is a part of a series of articles on the site that you're doing about commuter students, and it's trying to work out what we know about this group and how policy and practice can better support them. Fascinatingly, Susan Kenyon's research articulates that there are now more commuter students, and that's those that continue to live at home while studying, than there are traditional or residential students. And this is partly to do with widening participation, but also other factors such as the undersupply and the cost of student accommodation, as well as the general cost of living crisis, which is encouraging traditional students to remain at home. And the article makes a couple of arguments. Firstly, that institutions need to better see commuter students, make them visible not only to decision makers, but also to each other. And secondly, that policies in areas like timetabling and student support all need to be reviewed to consider how they fit with the lives of commuting students, as lots of these are still based on the assumption that students will relocate to attend university.
Now, this is super fascinating stuff. Omar, commuter students are like a kind of proper definable group in access terms, aren't they?
Sort of, although I think it is hard to track who is and isn't a commuter student. It varies quite a lot by provider. There's certainly a group that are more likely to be widening participation students. But I think, as Charlotte has just identified, I think one phenomenon is that the proportion of people who are commuting has increased, both, I think, post-COVID, but also with the rise in the cost of living and people not being able to afford student accommodation or student accommodation being unavailable. And sort of picking up DK's point, I think they are an identified group, and they're one that the Office for Students has identified as being potentially at risk in the Equality of Opportunity Risk Register when we're in universities are thinking about access and participation activities. But it's also the case that we don't have a great sort of statistical take on how many exactly there are, where they are at different universities, and of course, some of the outcomes data that would then flow from that. So, you know, are they more likely to drop out and are they more or less likely to get good jobs in the labor market? I think we do know some things about them, and it's certainly true that universities individually are collecting more data on them. But I think the lack of a sort of national defined statistic on commuter students does pose a challenge to understanding their experience. I think the research that you've pulled together on Wonky and from, I think, Susan Kenyon's work is extremely useful for giving a sense of, you know, the expansion of the number of commuter students and the fact that they do tend to have a poorer experience and outcome than their residential counterparts. And I think because we don't have strong enough robust data at the moment doesn't mean we don't have a strong enough indication from the data that we do have that there are these inequalities. And I think it does speak to the need, especially with now, I think it said 40% of HE students are commuter students, for universities to take the sort of changes in terms of not just travel, but how they access courses, how they access student life, that are sort of a sort of increasing focus. Yeah,
DK, there's another. This is, in many ways, this is a kind of another one of your data definition questions, isn't it? Because, you know, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, if someone had said, "What's a commuter student?" I'd have said, "Well, is someone in their first year living in halls of residence, and stood next to them is someone living with their parents on the other side of the city, and that's the commuter student." But you know, presumably there are, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of students who are away from home and commuting a bloody long way, and all sorts of other kind of, you know, things that start to disturb some of the data definitions. And if the data definitions, if everyone's talking at cross purposes, we've got a problem, haven't we?
It is always good to be clear about the students we're talking about. I think Susan Kenyon did this quite nicely in that she talks about the diversity of commuter students as a group. She broadly sees it as students who do not relocate in order to study. So students are living somewhere before they're students, and then they become students, but they're still living in the same place. Whether or not that means they actually commute, I mean, there are a number of places in the UK you can actually walk to your nearest university in a couple of minutes, and is that a commute? I'm not sure. But that's the definition she seems to be going with, and that's quite an inclusive one. She does say that these students tend to be students that have less economic advantages. They tend to be the first in family to be higher education. They tend to be from a low participation neighborhood. They tend to have caring commitments, family commitments, or work commitment. They tend to be over 25. And the kind of courses they access, the kind of places they access them, again, we're looking at part-time courses that are often quite vocational titling character that might be linked to a job the student's already doing or is intending to move up into, tends to be what we for some reason call lower tariff universities, in that it tends to be universities who specialize in dealing with these kind of students. If you're a commuter student somewhere where the majority of students are commuter students, or a large number of students are commuter students, you're probably going to have a better time than if you're in a place where literally nobody commutes, because it's just not that kind of university. There are also aspects of, like, are there commuter students by choice? There might be a student that really would like to live away from home, have applied to a university that is away from their usual home, but because they can't afford accommodation, they'll end up living with a distant family member and working part-time while studying, rather than having the traditional being in halls experience. So there's lots of different student experiences wrapped up in this overarching idea of a commuter student, although it is useful to have that term to think about, okay, these are students that are outside the kind of old-fashioned norm that we've grown to expect.
Yeah. Charlotte, I was reading your little collection of case summaries on student transfers this morning, which is really good, actually. If folks haven't seen it, do have a look. We'll put a link in the show notes. And actually, funnily enough, when I was reading it, one of my news alerts that popped up was, and I hadn't clocked this actually, that the Telford campus at University of Wolverhampton is closing. Now, I don't want to pick on Wolverhampton. There's lots of campuses closing around the country. But, you know, actually, it does feel like we're in this period where lots and lots of the sorts of spaces, often, you know, quite small campuses that people had, you know, study locations and so on, are coming under financial pressure and have to close. And that cuts off the ability for lots of what we might currently consider to be community students to actually commute, doesn't it? And that must be a real nightmare when those things actually happen.
Yeah, I think it's the intersection of these students with the financial sustainability and closures is really important. It won't be easy for a lot of these students to relocate if they need to or move to another campus. And in fact, in those case summaries that you mentioned, one of them, we highlight the issue of a student whose HE journey came to an end because of the cost of car parking because of a campus relocation. So it was solely that extra cost that meant that they couldn't continue their studies, which, you know, so you can just kind of see the knock-on impact that some of this will have for these individual students. I mean, most of the complaints we see from this group of students are around timetabling, especially changes at the last minute, because what we're seeing is that these students often have other responsibilities, whether that's childcare or disability support or employment. So I think it is a big problem when we're looking at closures as well.
And Omar, if we want more people that, you know, for whatever reason can't or won't or don't want to relocate to get into HE, that kind of by definition means that we've got to find some way collectively, institutionally, perhaps, you know, in terms of funding or whatever, to maintain geographical distribution of where they study, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it does. And, you know, I think there is a distinction also here between people. I mean, I was looking at some of the statistics in London in particular, because we have good statistics on that. Around half of ethnic minority students who go to university in London are commuter in the sense of living with their parent or guardian. So that's this very specific kind of commuter student. I think the other thought there is, obviously, I'm raising London not just because there's good statistics, because there's good public transport. And whether or not, you know, just picking up the point that Charlotte made around parking fees, is there stuff that universities need to be doing more now, taking into account the fact that more and more people are commuting, to facilitate that commute, to take maybe, you know, to think about parking, but also to think about whether or not they need to put on additional bus routes, whether or not they need to work with local authorities on that kind of to improve that journey? Because obviously, there's a cost implication there, but there's also a time, right? So, you know, time commuting is time that you're not in lectures or time that you're not working. And the longer the commute, I think the greater the risk that you might have a poor student experience and poor student outcomes. So I think there are things, I think, that providers, universities could be doing to be more responsive to this change as well, not just sort of indicate that this is a change preference of the kinds of students that we've got, or that the sort of increase of the cost of living or the kinds of widening participation students are more likely to do this. That's all well and good, but I think trying to reduce the costs of the commute, whether that's financial costs or whether that's the cost in terms of access to a good lecture experience or a good social experience, I think are incumbent on universities.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Omar, Charlotte, DK, Michael, Salmon, who also makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.